Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. Historical Ghost Stories, Volume 2. First story, Jasmine. The facts are contributed by Mr. Azlet Baldwin, and the story narrated by Gwladys Townsend of Raynham. All stories connected with ghosts of children make an especial appeal to the heart. They are rarely unhappy, these sweet returns, who occasionally escape from the nurseries of heaven to revisit places associated with their brief sojourn on earth. For what reason do they come back? I have heard of one ghost child who, during the night, tidied a room and arranged the flowers as she used to do. Another small child rescued from drowning, only to die an hour later, haunts the house where it died, and the patter of its tiny feet is constantly heard in the tiled hall. At one time, Beminster School was haunted by the apparition of John Daniel, a schoolboy who appeared to five of the pupils, one of whom had not even seen him when alive, and who proved his identity by a wonderful piece of circumstantial evidence. It is pathetic to think of the murdered lad reappearing in a place where he used to play with boys who now only knew him as a shadow. Certain rooms in Trinity College, Cambridge, are haunted by a child who wanders about moaning with the palms of its hands turned outwards. And in a house in Yorkshire, many visitors have seen the figure of a little dark-haired girl, always wearing her nightdress, who seems to be in great trouble and who never comes twice into the same room. A boy and a white rabbit, only seen by children living in the house haunted an old manor in Somerset, and who does not appreciate the poignancy of the story of the ghost of a newly buried child, who returned to entreat its broken-hearted mother not to weep so much. "Your tears have made my shroud so wet, I cannot sleep," it complained, exactly in the same way that a living child would become peevish if its night's rest were made uncomfortable. It is a homely little ghost story, pointing a moral not to grieve over much, especially for the joyous band of children who will never know the sufferings entailed by sin, or happiest thought of all, will never meet the worst of enemies in their own sins armed against them. I do not know whether Mr. Azlet Baldwin believes in ghosts, but he has contributed these startling psychic experiences told him by someone who stayed in the house with a haunted garden, and vouches for the truth of everything set down in the story of Jasmine, a little flower gathered by the master many years ago. The house associated with the hauntings had been bought quite recently by Mr. S., a friend of the man. Let us call him C., who knows Mr. Azlet Baldwin. The delightful old hall was an ideal retreat for a bachelor with bookish taste, and C. congratulated his friend on his find. After dinner, they strolled about the admirably kept grounds, merging imperceptibly into pine woods as these dark caves of mystery which partly surrounded the house. All at once, he noticed a long winding path, so neglected as to be almost overgrown. New hedges bordered it, and climbing roses on the other side had pushed their way through the hedges and waved imploring arms, weighted with scented loveliness to attract the attention of those who walked in the garden. This blatant disorder in the midst of the studied order of the other part of the grounds puzzled C. His host saw the silent note of interrogation registered in his face. "Looking at that path, are you? Well, you couldn't miss it. However, I've a fancy to let it run wild. In another year, nobody will be able to walk down it." He paused significantly. "I have good reason for raising it level with the ground, but somehow I can't bring myself to do it. However, I always give it a wide berth. It's haunted, and I'll tell you what happens there, if you have patience to listen without thinking. I'm heading for the road where madness lies." They were now standing some distance away on the soft velvet of the lawn facing the path. The evening sky was jade green, the trees edged sharply against it. Bats circled in the soft air, the sickle of the crescent moon will presently reap the harvest of the stars. Suddenly a child's laugh, piercingly sweet and clear, as a blackbird's note came from the direction of the path. You heard that, said S. Let's go indoors. It seemed to see as if part of the house were asleep, but he felt life still went on behind the dark, observant windows. That wing looks uninhabited, he said. It certainly is, replied S. They closed the ancient entrance door and shut out the perfume of the flower incense rising from the pale tobacco flowers, the passionate fragrance of the magnolia, the cloying sweetness of syringia, and the clean scent of many roses. The library, where the friends sat and smoked, was comfortably remote. No sounds penetrated its cloistered calm, and the old books looked like watchful rows of brown-ground Franciscans. I believe this place is making me fanciful, said C, or else it's waiting for your story. Well, you shall have it. I bought this property a year ago. Nothing odd about it, except that for years it hadn't been let or sold, and it was in a very bad repair. I got it for a song. I wanted to make it beautiful and dignified again. Some old houses can stand their faces being lifted. I made a thorough survey. The wing you saw had evidently been given over to generations of children. All sorts of reminders of them remained. Penciled marks and dates of their heights. Initials cut in the paneling, and we found a derelict 18th century doll in a walled-up cupboard. I'm sure that little boys had knelt on the wide window seats and flattened their noses against the panes on wet days, counting the raindrops, chasing one another down the glass, and little girls had sat in front of the wide fireplace. I suppose it had once been one of those high brass fenders, and played hide-and-seek in the long passage which connects this wing with our part of the house. But directly I set foot there, I felt that there was something impossible to grapple with, something that drove me away, didn't want me. So I had the place made sound and left it at that. I'm quite all right on this side of the house. C said, what a waste of space. Possibly, but strange to say, nobody hereabouts was surprised. However, things began to happen when I took the garden in hand. At first, I used to motor down from town, spend a few hours with a builder and a gardener who understood the gardens. One afternoon last spring, I thought I'd like to be alone. It was a heavenly day, a jolly little wind investigating every corner, clouds chasing each other across the sky, everything waking up. Even the dignified yew had put forth tiny green shoots. It was then I heard a rustle behind the hedge, as if children were in hiding. I say children because the rustle was quite low down. I was being stalked, watched, hidden from, and I had been told there wasn't a cottage or a child within a mile radius. Afterwards came a confusion of voices, falling over one another in rippling cascades of laughter, shrill, sweet laughter. You heard some of it an hour ago. I went back to the house, spoke to the old caretaker. Look here, I said, I won't have strange children running about the grounds. The cross-grained ancient stared. God love you, sir. Did he say children? I tell you, there bit none of them audacious little varmints. None of them would show their faces here, scared stiff they be of them others. And a good thing, a summer can scare 'em. But I heard children talking and playing. He laughed, a rusty, creaky chuckle. Take no notice, he said. And he refused to be drawn. I'm telling you to take no notice, he repeated. The first day I came to live here, I went to the path. This time the footsteps and the voices were insistent, and words, afterwards sentences, detached themselves from the confusion of little tongues. Somebody said, we want to hear about your sister. I took no notice. Yes, chorused the voices. Do tell us where she is. We would like to come and play with us. I said sharply, conscious that I was making a perfect fool of myself. I haven't a sister. The path echoed with derisive laughter. Of course you have. You know you have. You mustn't tell lies. It's wicked. Liars go to hell. You know more than I do, I retorted. If I had a sister, tell me her name. And all the unseen children shouted, it's Jasmine. We'll spell it for you. J-A-S-M-I-N. Jasmine without the E, said a voice. Such a pretty flower. It smells so sweet. I didn't want to hear any more. I wasn't frightened, but I was more or less annoyed and puzzled. Evidently, that particular path belonged to the ghosts of the children who had died here in childhood, and I remembered having noticed many wall tablets in the old church commemorating the names of those who died in their infancy. The former owners of the hall had been prolific parents, but the majority of their large families did not reach maturity. An old decadent stock, so I was informed, which finally flickered out more than 50 years ago. Still, I couldn't forget the name Jasmine. I supposed myself to be an only son, born at a period of her life when my mother had never expected to bear a child. I had not heard of the existence of any other. My mother is now a very old lady, living with her memories. Hitherto, I had never ruffled the serene surface of her thoughts. Now I decided to do so. I went to see her. There's a nurse always in attendance, but mother's not senile, only remote and self-absorbed. Outwardly, her life is bounded by the Bible, parts of which she knows by heart, and the satisfaction of seeing a few selected friends. She thinks back a great deal when she lies awake at night and gets frightened by age and death. She doesn't want to die when it's dark. Nurse declares she won't. "I'm pleased to see you," she said. "And how is your house progressing? It is a pity I am not able to help you in your arrangements. At my age, the journey would kill me." I drew a bow at a venture. If I only had a sister, how useful she would be. "A sister? Did you say a sister? Let me think." Submerged memories were evidently rising from the sea of the past. "But John, you had a baby sister. I never talked about her. I never have. It was a great sorrow." Two difficult tears trailed their slow course through the furrows of old age. "Yes, a pretty little thing, hair like spun silk. I called her Jasmine, after the jasmine growing round our bedroom window. But I spelt her name differently. She did not live. It's many years ago." There's not much more to tell, but that little is curious. A week later, when I was sitting outside in the twilight, a child's hand crept slowly into mine. A little hand, with a helpless clinging fingers which appeal so much to women, and a sweet, far-off voice said, "I am Jasmine. You must not let the children trouble you. The next time they ask about me, please say, 'I have nothing for you,' and then they will go away." Afterwards, the little hand was quietly withdrawn. I could not wait. I went to the path. No sooner had I done so than I was surrounded by the unseen children, pressing hard on one another's heels. "Now you know that you had a sister, but why does she not come here?" said the leader. I answered, "You were quite right. I had a sister. Her name was Jasmine. I've been talking to her. She has sent you a message." "What is it?" clamored a score of voices. "Just this. I have nothing for you." The effect was electrical. A long, tense silence. Afterwards, a general stampede. Children taking cover, scampering away in all directions like frightened rabbits. The Ewok was deserted. As Jasmine had promised, they never came back, at any rate when I was anywhere near. I've thought it over, time after time, and it always becomes more and more fantastic. Although everything is true, you can't get away from the name and the fact that I had a sister called Jasmine. "I don't expect you to believe such an impossible story," said S, apologetically, but evidently trying to excuse himself for having unburdened his mind. "Hang it all, old fellow. You heard a child laugh, didn't you?" Three Ghost Stories, contributed by Princess Marina Chechavitz. The first, The Haunted House on the Valavesky Island. In Russia, ghosts and ghost stories are not traditions of centuries, as is the case in Western Europe. With us, the belief in the supernatural is usually based on natural phenomena and the emotions which they inspire. And this condition, besides representing a survival of paganism, creates friendly and inimical beings who take part in the daily life of the Russian peasant. Any close communion with nature is bound to result in a belief, which necessitates giving a supernatural explanation of those forces, which especially stimulate the imagination. In fact, all over the world, the worship of nature spirits persist in one form or another. The best-known Russian nature spirit, associated solely with woods and forests, is known as the Leshy, whose whole time occupation is either to make travelers lose their way or else to frighten them out of their wits. In this aspect, he somewhat resembles the Fata Morgana of Italy, the Faux-Follet of France, the Earl King of Germany, and the English Will-o'-the-Wisp and Jack-o'-Lantern. Another spirit, the Domovoy, who frequents all inhabited places, is more or less a companion of the Russian peasant. The Domovoy is a frivolous, irresponsible creature who indulges in all kinds of practical jokes in the farms and cottages. But unlike the pixies, the brownies, and the Irish leprechaun, the Domovoy does not believe in work, so he never helps but only hinders. He specializes in hiding things when they are most needed. He loves to bang doors and startle harmless old people dozing by the fireside, although to do him credit, he thoroughly succeeds and putting fear into the hearts of incorrigibly naughty children. The Domovoy touches the heights of his semi-malicious activities when he appears in the kitchen and meddles with the cooking, spoiling the cakes and bread by making the batch as flat as a proverbial pancake or else as heavy as lead. All domestic worries, great and small, I put down to the Domovoy. But as this joyous scapegoat possesses a back sufficiently broad to bear the multitudinous charges laid to his door, he continues even in modern Russia to pursue the uneven tenor of his way. The reason for the dearth of ghosts in Russia may be due to the changeable conditions of life throughout her history, and more prosaic still, to the comparatively recent use of stone in building, which not only has prevented the creation of ancient houses and castles, but has deprived new ones of the tradition inseparable from antiquity. But wherever the boundaries of Russia touch on the older civilizations of the Caucasus or Baltic provinces, ghosts and ghost stories immediately enter into local legend. I do not wish to give the impression that ghosts do not walk in Russia. In most important houses dating from the 17th and 18th centuries, you find the usual family ghosts, omens and warnings, and some of our well-known authors, Gogol in particular, have made ample use of the supernatural element in their midst. No doubt the atrocities and poignant dramas of the Revolution accounts for many present-day returns, some of which haunt the scenes of their violent exits from life. Hauntings in the prisons are a foregone conclusion, and the race of the murdered imperial family must be inseparable from Ekaterinburg. Even in 1924, the place was enveloped in an aura of tragedy, and when Isadora Duncan visited it, she described it as a living nightmare. "You have no idea what a living nightmare is until you see this town," she wrote. Perhaps the killing of a certain family has cast a sort of Edgar Allan Poe gloom over it. The melancholy church bells ring every hour, fearful to hear. "We saw the house in the cellar where they shot a certain family." Its psychosis seems to pervade the atmosphere. You can't imagine anything more fearful. And there are many other tragedies of those days, which have left their imperishable records on souls and on environment. My first ghost story, which provided one of the greatest sensations of pre-war Petersburg, concerned a haunted house situated on the Valavesky Island opposite the Nikolaevsky Bridge. The house had been unoccupied for many years, and externally it lived up to its sinister reputation as a house under some prodigious ban of excommunication. However, two students who disbelieved in any kind of superstition and scoffed at supernatural manifestations planned to destroy the legend by passing the night there, holding themselves in readiness to tackle any ghost bold enough to appear. The owner of the property, anxious to reinstate the house as a selling or letting proposition, gladly gave permission to let the ghost seers stay as long as they liked, and he made arrangements to have a good fire lighted in what was known as the haunted room, besides supplying two chairs and a table, as the friends proposed having supper before commencing to watch out. Everything was soon in readiness. Provisions and wines were sent in, and a goodly supply of candles to lighten the darkness completed the equipment for the night. C, for it is better to describe him as an initial, arrived punctually at the time fixed for the meeting. Apart from his mulish obstinacy, where the supernatural was concerned, he was a nice young fellow who entered into the spirit of the adventure on this cold, rainy autumn evening, and as he liked his comforts, he was cheered by the thought that the vigil would not take place in a fireless room. He therefore unlocked the front door with pleasurable anticipation, not only of being thrilled, but also of being warmed. The hall was in darkness, and when C's electric torch flashed here and there, he understood how different empty houses feel at night. During the day, they are just empty. At night, they become alive and belong to the unseen, or to the shadows of those who have lived and died within their walls. At night, the complainings of any old houses are pathetic, especially when its creaking old bones resent the burden of the years and the dry rot which gradually eats into its heart. To suffer like this, a house must be old, and few modern buildings possess the capacity either for suffering or for endurance. Upstairs, someone was singing, and C recognized his friend's voice in company with a curiously distorted echo. Keeping up his spirits, said C to himself, but suddenly the echo set in movement something definitely malignant. The house became a receptacle for an immense, resistless power, and C sensed an imperishable record of incarnate evil. Reproaching himself for possessing imagination, C went upstairs and opened the door of the room from whence the voice and the echo proceeded. A fire of ship's timber blazed on the open hearth, and flames of red, blue, green, and faint lilac danced and pursued each other upwards in a carnivalesque riot of color. The table was set for supper, and lighted candles and heavy candlesticks stood on a marble side buffet, a relic of the house's former state. In this aspect, the room had nothing approaching the supernatural about it. Taking off his heavy overcoat, C greeted P and asked him how long he had been waiting. "I didn't know you meant to steal a march on me," he said. "Merely my fancy," answered P. "I wanted to get in touch with the unseen." "And did you?" "Yes and no." And he began to sing in a voice lacking all youth and clearness, the sound cleaving the warm wood-scented air like a meteor. C, hitherto only accustomed to hearing P sing student songs with an occasional excerpt from musical comedy, was by turns attracted and repelled. He even experienced a vague feeling of panic. For a moment it seemed as if a devil were making music. With something of an effort, he said, "Well, let's have supper. By the way, what language were you singing? I couldn't understand a word of it." "Naturally not," and P smiled at him across the table, a wicked cynical smile which perplexed the already perplexed C. This might be P who sang and smiled, but it certainly was not the familiar light-hearted P of the daily round. He said nothing and tried to think and act normally, but from time to time he looked at his friend, who was enjoying his supper with a healthy appetite, while C ate sparingly and only drank a couple of glasses of wine. At last P began to talk about the house. "I wonder what we shall see," he said. "Don't you think it is a little presumptuous to disturb well-buried evil by reason of senseless curiosity? Perhaps this house belongs to one who is adored through fear, whose strength lies in destruction, and who might resent our intrusion." "But you were the first to propose to investigate the haunting," said C. "Have you by any chance become a convert to the religion whose God is adored through fear?" P threw him a dark look. "We won't discuss religion. Better by far to toast midnight in a libation to evil." He tossed off the contents of his glass, refilled it, and flung the red wine onto the merry flames. "A libation to evil," he cried. Suddenly his whole personality changed, and with a snarl he turned to C. "You poor fool," he cried, "to attempt to measure your strength against those whose strength is invincible. You thought to destroy the indestructible, to uproot as easily as weeds forces whose roots are older than time. Do you think that you deserve punishment?" As he spoke, P rose from his chair, still smiling his cruel, mocking smile, and C stared at him, incapable of thought or movement, conscious only that he was a helpless prisoner of the powers of darkness. The last thing C remembered was P's tiger-like spring. His throat was seized by fingers which burnt like acid into his flesh, then darkness fell. Next morning, C and P were absent from the university, and as they had missed a special noonday lecture important for both, some fellow students who knew about the experiment at the haunted house decided to go and see what had become of the ghost hunters. To their disappointment, there was nothing frightening about the place. The silken curtains spun by successive generations of spiders waved across the windows, and when the door opened to admit the autumn air, an inquisitive ray of watery sunlight darted across the floors and up the broad staircase, followed by the little group. When they went into the room on the first floor, cold gray ash and burnt out candles met their eyes. Afterwards, they noticed an overturned table and broken plates and pieces of food strewed the floor, where the spilt wine looked like a stream of congealed blood. Something lay under the debris. This was C, evidently in a dead faint or worse. There was no sign of P, so while two of the young men busied themselves in bringing C around, the others hurried upstairs to see if P was anywhere in hiding. The rooms were empty save for gigantic bloated spiders scuttling away in the gloom. The dust of years rose like musty incense from cracks in the boards as the searchers hurried over them, and in the garrets, battalions of bats clung to the worm-eaten beams. The students concluded that P had gone suddenly mad and attacked C in a moment of frenzy. There was nothing else to do but to take C back to his home. He was now somewhat restored, but incapable of giving them any information, making inquiries at P's lodgings, and if necessary, report the affair to the police. A closed carriage was fetched, and C, looking as if he had passed the night in hell and not in an empty house, was restored to his family who, although alarmed at his condition, could not resist the chance it gave them to repeat the familiar formula, "I told you so," on every possible occasion. The next halt was at P's lodging, a few streets away. The inquiry as to whether he was at home instantly produced a running commentary from the landlady. Was he at home? Yes, he was, and judging from his appearance, likely to remain at home for the next few days. She didn't know whether too much learning or too much seeing life made anyone sleep like the dead. He came in at 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon, went straight to bed, and has not gotten up since, sleeping all the time. It would be a good thing to rouse him. So far, she hadn't been able to do anything with him. More than ever amazed, the young men went to P's room. Sure enough, there he was, sleeping and snoring heavily. And yet, she says he went to bed at 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon, said the leader, and with another willing helper, he shook the sleeper as one shakes an apple on the topmost bough. P reluctantly opened his eyes. "What on earth are you fellows doing in my room?" he grumbled. They explained the reason, and awakened to some purpose, P sat up and stared at them uncomprehendingly. At last, the gravity of their story gradually dawned on him. "Then it was yesterday that we planned to go to the house on the island." He was assured that it was so. "And you come and tell me some cock and bull story about finding C half murdered, and that there was evidence of two people having eaten together? Are we all mad? I've never stirred out of this place. My landlady can prove it. I forgot the appointment, but I remember I felt curiously tired and had a sort of drug sensation when I came back to lunch. In fact, I became so drowsy that I went to bed. I never gave a thought to C or to the haunted house, so if there were two people at supper, the second one wasn't me." There, for the moment, the matter ended. P's 28-hour alibi was provided by his landlady and her servant, as well as by a friend who had called later in the evening. On the other hand, C's incredible story was confirmed by the condition of the room, his own pitiable state, and the statements of eyewitnesses. But strangest of all, the imprints on his throat could never have been made by the spatulated fingers on P's rather pudgy little hand. The mystery of this authentic story of the supernatural has remained unsolved. It created an immense amount of talk and speculation in Petersburg, but no clue was ever found as to the identity of C's supper companion. It was a clear case of like and unlike, with something deeper still, something that made even unimaginative people afraid. And when shortly afterward the owner of the house on the island decided to pull it down, not one stone was left upon another, the ill-omened place with its evil entities and unsolved mysteries. The Stairless Tower. The Stairless Tower is not a ghost story, being only associated with death warnings peculiar to certain families in one form or another. And this particular warning concerns friends of mine, Baron and Baroness R., who own a beautiful estate in the country, where the ruins of an ancient tower stood in the garden surrounding the house. The tower had only one window, and as its stairs had long since been destroyed, it was merely a picturesque, inaccessible shell, covered with ivy and a few wind-sown wild flowers. According to tradition, Whenever a member of the R family died, a light gleamed through the tower window, although nobody could give a practical reason to account for it. One summer evening, Baron R's two daughters and a friend went for an after-dinner stroll and, not noticing how far they had walked, found themselves to all intents and purposes lost in the soft darkness of a moonless night. Fortunately, the woodland paths on their father's estate were well kept and clearly defined, so it was not difficult to feel their way back to the gardens, and as they walked up the avenue dominated by the stairless tower, the girl stopped and a little shiver passed from one to the other. They had both seen a light shining in the tower window, with a curious searchlight effect, partly phosphorescent and partly flame, which streamed like a white ribbon on the night. The sisters looked at each other. "Do you see anything?" whispered the elder girl. "Yes," faltered her sister, "there's a light in the tower." To their friend, who did not know the story of the death warning, she said, trying to speak naturally, "Surely, there's a light somewhere?" "Of course there is," he laughed. "Why, it's in the tower. However, has anyone managed to get up there?" "Perhaps they've flown in," he added. The light was still shining in the barred window when they returned to the house, and it continued to shine until an hour later, when a telephone call came through, informing the Baron of the sudden death of his eldest son. Afterward, the stairless tower became part of the darkness. "The warning given to a member of my family of the impending assassination of the Emperor Alexander II. On Saturday, February 28, 1881, another and more ghostly kind of warning occurred in our family, the recipient being the young Countess S. And it is necessary in the cause of truth to say that on this particular evening, no discussion of any kind had taken place about ghosts or psychic phenomena, and the Countess had gone to bed in a perfectly normal frame of mind. The first hour or so she slept soundly, then she awoke with a start to see by the dim light of the velouse someone leaning over the low bed rail. The figure was that of a pale-faced old man with a long white beard, wearing some kind of flowing dark robe. His expression was gentle, mingled with a sense of tragedy, and the Countess heard him say very solemnly, "Tomorrow at noon, the Emperor Alexander II will be assassinated." He then disappeared, and the terrified Countess awakened her husband and told him of her vision and the old man's ominous words. The ordinary type of husbands have no use for the supernatural, and they do not show much sympathy when it becomes a question of dreaming dreams or seeing visions. Count S. listened patiently to the story of the old man's warning, laughed a little, comforted his wife, and told her to go to sleep. The young wife was not imaginative. She wanted to go to sleep, but the old man appeared twice more during that nerve-shattering night, and each time he reiterated his statement of the approaching assassination of the emperor. After the third visitation, she lay weeping silently, with frayed-out nerves, by this time absolutely convinced that it was the emperor's last day on earth. That morning, Count S. was on duty with his regiment for the Trooping of the Colors. This ceremony was to take place in the presence of the emperor, and knowing the time when it would be over, the Countess hurried along the embankment to meet her husband as he came back. She was more than ever impressed with the drama of the night, and she felt the only way to combat her fears was to face matters and not to wait for someone to tell her the best or the worst. Directly she saw her husband riding towards her, she knew from his expression that the old man of her vision had spoken the truth, and although Count S. was a soldier with a soldier's self-control, a little of his composure failed him when he saw his wife's pale face and read the unspoken question in her frightened eyes. So he said very quietly, "You were right. The emperor has been murdered." I wish I could finish this true family record with some more interesting details, but none are available. It is a fact that Countess S. saw the apparition three times consecutively, and her husband always corroborated her statement. In any case, the Count could not have prevented the assassination of the emperor, and it is doubtful whether anyone in his entourage would have listened or paid any attention to the story of a waking dream. But those who query the importance of the supernatural in daily life may justifiably argue that the ghostly warning ought to have been given direct to the emperor or to one of the officers responsible for the arrangements on that fatal morning. However, in many cases of supernatural manifestations, the real reason often remains unexplained.